The Martin and Ruth Massengale Lectureship was created to support a distinguished scientist at the CSSA annual meetings who has made significant contributions to new and innovative research in crop physiology and metabolism, turf grass science, or forage and grazing lands. And it rotates, and so this year the lectureship, I guess the nomination process, was focused on crop physiology. The lectureship was established by Martin and Ruth Massengale in 2008, and if the Massengales were here, we'd like to recognize them, but don't see them. Dr. Massengale is Distinguished Professor and President Emeritus from the University of Nebraska and a former CSSA President. And our 2011 lecturer is William Davies, who will be presenting the talk, Managing Plant-Soil Interactions for Sustainable Intensification of Agriculture. He asked me not to embarrass him too much by saying lots of things, but he is a truly distinguished science. He's Distinguished Professor of Environmental Plant Biology at Lancaster University, and until 2008 was Director of the Lancaster Environmental Center. He has he's an ISI highly cited author and has a tremendous list of publications in the area of root biology. He's also now, I guess, has a very active collaboration in China, and I know he's been working recently for an initiative on food security, which I'm sure he'd be glad to discuss with people after the talk in breaks or whatever. So I think with no further ado, I'll invite Bill up here to give the lecture. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor, obviously, and a real pleasure to be here. I'd like to start by acknowledging my co-authors, Ian Dodd and Sally Wilkinson, who I think are known to many of you. I'll try and point out as we go through just where their particular contributions are going to be. The talk that I hope to give is just a very brief introduction around this issue of food security. There is an increased demand for food, obviously, for all sorts of reasons. I'll say a little bit about that. It's clear that while we strive for that end, it's not something that we can do at all costs, if indeed we can do it at all. I would like to try to talk a little bit about some of the science that I think will help, and I'm going to put an emphasis on regulation of growth, with a particular emphasis on regulation, rather than looking for stress resistance in the more classic sense of the word. We're starting out this afternoon an extended discussion on roots, and so I'm going to focus my attention, the science that I will discuss will be in the general area of rhizosphere biology, and I'm going to look at trying to deliver this sort of holy grail, the idea that we can produce more food by using less water and nutrient, and talk a little bit at the end about some what I hope is new biology for many. So the challenge that we have is this idea of perhaps doubling food supply, more conservatively, perhaps an increase in around 50% in food supply by 2030 or so. In the UK, our chief scientist, John Beddington, and others have coined the term perfect storm, where we're faced now, not just something that's going to happen in the future, we're faced now with increasing population. The climate is changing, which will make food production certainly more difficult. There is a limit on the availability of land, water, energy, and so this is a pretty hard ask. I should say at the outset that if we look at this diagram of what is thought to be the food system, which underpins food security or otherwise, we're not just talking about food production. I mean, it's obviously here, but even within this general area of food availability, it's only one of the things which determines how much people have to eat. And there are other considerations which determine food security or otherwise, and those are issues around the utilization and the access that people have to food. And many of those issues, of course, are social science issues, or they can be cultural issues. And many people look at this so-called system and say, well, this is a pretty complex series of issues. There are all sorts of trade-offs between these things. In fact, I would like to say that I think it's worse than this. I mean, there are real tensions between these things, and that's particularly true perhaps between the production and the distribution of food, the food supply chain, and this issue of what everything that we're doing is doing to the environment. And we'll talk a little bit about that. I mean, obviously, we're here at a crop science meeting. We're going to talk about crop science, but we need to keep in mind some of these other variables. So let's look at some crop science, and let's start with a success story, which is China's production of food. And this is what China has achieved in the last 30 years compared to the rest of us. On this axis, this is per capita food production. So we look at this, and we should, I think, have some hope that the challenge which faces us for the future is achievable. I mean, if it's been possible to do this, we should look perhaps to see how it's been achieved and see whether there are lessons there that we can learn. And this slide, which it's taken from a paper that we've recently produced with Fu Sozhang and colleagues, Minshen Fang, the primary author is here, shows a good example of intensification of agriculture, with grain yield per unit area increasing from the 1960s to the present day. This is the area of land under cultivation in China. It's actually gone down over this period. But of course, these other lines give us some idea of how a lot of this extra food production has been achieved. It's been achieved by using tremendous amounts of water, nutrients, agrochemicals, and plastics, which are largely used for plastic glasshouses and for soil mulch. So I think without even analyzing this much further, we could look at this and say, well, this has been success, but it's hardly sustainable intensification. And we know all too well that in many parts of the world, this is a slide I picked up in CIMMYT earlier this year, looking at the reduction of water availability in aquifers under Mexico. This is a situation that's repeated around the world. We know there's a lot to play for in this area. We can't just go on using water and fertilizers at the rate in which, and energy at the rates we've been using them. And a similar story in northwest China, in Gansu province, one of the driest parts of China, massive environmental problems caused partly as a result of a changing climate, but partly as a result of overuse of water in agriculture. So falling water tables, desertification, dust storms, really significant issues for people, socioeconomic implications of people having to move out of these areas because they simply can't survive. Now, I'm not suggesting we'll be seeing this in southwest England or anything like that in the immediate future, but this, I think, is a model for us. It shows us that we must take many of these issues very, very seriously. Now, what I'm going to suggest to you is that there are opportunities for us in this general area of rhizosphere biology, and that we can think about managing the rhizosphere, and that there are a number of possibilities that are open to us. And I mean, this is really the topic of the symposium, and I want to just run through a series of possibilities and show you one or two things that we've been doing in Lancaster. And I'll be looking at manipulations of the root system, different root growth characteristics, roots that behave in different ways. looking obviously at manipulating the environment in the soil, using deficit irrigation, using fertigation and other nutrient placement techniques. And also, I hope, if there are just a couple of minutes at the end, talk a little bit about the possibilities of manipulating microbials. So they're all management techniques which I believe can contribute to this aim of producing more crop per drop. And we would superimpose those sorts of things that are based upon what we hope is sound, novel physiology that can be exploited to the benefit of the farmer. Other sorts of systems management, we've heard a lot at this meeting about conservation agriculture, intercropping rotations, and of course the whole business of plant improvement. And one of the arguments that I want to make is that much of the science which we use to manipulate these kinds of things is also accessible to plant breeders, and I'll try and make the case for one particular set of scientific variables. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how plants perceive environmental stress, particularly drought stress, how they respond to it, and our group has worked for just a few more years than I really care to think about around this idea of perception of stress and the signaling of stress and the responses shown by crops to this sort of stress. And I'll show you some very quick examples of the kind of science which we think is important here. It's relatively novel still, because not so many years ago people based most of their thinking around hydraulics, the hydraulics of the response, and we think there are other components to this response. And I'll show you quickly how I think some of that science is already being applied in agriculture, in the field, to deliver some of these highly desirable end products. So I want to start by just looking at the perception of edaphic stresses by plants. And this paper, which has just appeared in Plants and Environment by my colleague Ian Dodd, is a very nice example, I think, of the sort of science that we think is important and we've worked on for a good number of years, but this is a nice visual indication of what goes on. Three cartoons here showing that if you increase the number of roots in a dry compartment, this is a greenhouse experiment, the impact of having more roots in a dry compartment, the plants have all got access to the same amount of water, there's a significant effect of that on leaf growth, and there's a significant effect of that on abscisic acid, in this case in the leaf, but also in the xylem. So the implication here is that there's a chemical signal arising as a result of an interaction between an increasing number of roots and drying soil. That's generating this growth inhibitor, which is moving from the roots to the shoots as a signal and potentially regulating leaf growth. Now, there are all sorts of subtleties to this, but that sort of gives you the idea of what I think can be going on in terms of chemical regulation of growth in response to changes in the soil environment. Here's another example. This is some data from a paper published by Sally Wilkinson a few years ago now, where she showed how the pH of the xylem sap can increase as the soil around the roots, in this case of a tomato plant, is drying. It's a very significant change in pH. If you feed xylem sap buffered to either a relatively acidic pH equivalent to a well-watered sap, and you feed sap which is buffered to a pH which is the sort of thing that you find in plants in drying soil, you can see the impact of those two saps on transpiration. This is simple transpiration bioassay, is significant. And simply by alkalizing the sap, no more chemical inhibitors or anything like that, just a higher pH, you can close the stomata. And this has led us to recommend to growers in the UK to irrigate with slightly more alkaline irrigation water. And this is proving to be quite successful in terms of saving saving water use in crop production. A little bit more detail, you can use a confocal microscope to look, and pH sensitive dyes to look at the pH in the cell walls of the leaf in response to changes in nitrogen supply to the root system or changes in water availability or indeed in response to changes in the transpiration rate of the plant. And all of those treatments can result in alkalinization. I won't go into details, but this is actually the response to an increase in supply of nitrate to the plant. And the walls get a lot more alkaline. And Sally Wilkinson has published now a mechanism to explain the impact of this alkaline pH, which she suggests, and I think the evidence that she's achieved is excellent. It suggests this causes what abscisic acid is available in the leaf to reside for longer in the apoplast, and this has a bigger effect on stomata. So you can regulate gas exchange simply by changing the distribution of abscisic acid through the leaf. You don't need to synthesize anymore. It's a very, very sensitive way of regulating gas exchange. Now, I suggested to you you could cause those sorts of changes by changing the pH of irrigation water. You can also do it simply by allowing some of the soil around the plant to dry, so subjecting plants to controlled soil drying. And this is a meta-analysis which has been published in the last by Ian initially and then some further analysis more recently to show how a small amount of water, effectively a deficit irrigation treatment, applied in two ways. First of all, as a simple regulated deficit with random application of water to the soil distributed over the whole root system. Alternatively, the same amount of water just tipped onto part of the root system. So this is a partial root zone drying treatment. Now, you might expect that those two treatments would have pretty much the same effect on crop yield. But the reality is, if that was the case, all of those bars would be here and one. And you can see that almost invariably, the partial root zone drying treatment results in a higher yield for the water use that's applied. In other words, more crop per drop. This is a very, very simple, low-cost irrigation technique. It's been used across the world in a variety of guises. There's quite a lot of interest in alternate wetting and drying irrigation now in Asia around rice. And there's quite a lot of information around just exactly what the partial root zone drying or alternate wetting and drying is doing. Changes in hormones, which we've looked at, possibilities that partitioning of assimilates in response to this these hormone changes are happening. Show you an example of that. And some work that a colleague of ours, Phil Haygarth, did a few years ago to show wetting and drying mineralizes soils and makes certain phosphorus, for example, more available to plants with potentially positive effects on yield. And these are some data by collaborators Yang and Zhang in China to show this partitioning effect, a small amount of water, very modest soil drying. These are the treatments, two well-watered ones, two water-stressed ones. If you compare one and three, you can see the water-stressed treatment post-anthesis is so mild it's not affecting the total yield. If you superimpose a high nitrogen treatment on those, and that delays senescence of rice, in this case, same response in wheat, you can see that the high nitrogen reduces grain yield. We understand the base mechanistic basis of that. When you apply the high nitrogen and the drought stress together, there's a really significant increase in grain yield for a reduced amount of water. So the principle here is a little bit of knowledge, physiological understanding, I would argue, can go quite a long way. Okay, I want to give you another example of this kind of signaling science and its potential exploitation, and I want to talk about the possibility that the plant uses this sort of signal to integrate the impacts of edaphic and atmospheric stresses. And I'm going to talk specifically about drought and ozone stress, which is an increasing problem in many parts of the world. And we have a project that's just getting going in South Asia, in the Indo-Gangetic Plain. We're focusing on wheat. There's a real problem there, combinations of heat, ozone, water deficit. Modeling suggests that there will be a massive impact on maize production and on wheat production in this region very soon. And a lot, we're beginning to see a lot of this already. Obviously, there's a very high population here, and there are already big, significant, and important effects of using too much water in agriculture. So these are serious. These are serious effects. So what are the problems? Well, one of the problems is very poor air quality, and people have known that ozone has damaging effects on crop yields, and some of the modelling that's occurring now in part as part of these international projects suggests this is quite serious for food production. There's quite a lot of debate about how ozone actually damages yield. Interestingly, ozone causes plants to produce a lot more ethylene, and we think this is important, and I'll show you why. But before that, I want to make the point to you that in many circumstances, water deficits and nutrient deficits, certainly high temperature, too much water also, can all perturb the ethylene biology of plants, generally resulting in increased ethylene accumulation. And the impacts of that are almost invariably negative. So there are significant effects on vegetative growth, gas exchange, and importantly, I think, on reproductive development. So, no, those are quite important effects that potentially might be caused by one piece of biology, ethylene biology, which could integrate all of those different environmental effects, which under many circumstances do occur together. Ozone concentrations are highest in the atmosphere when the temperature is high and generally when water is in short supply. Now let me show you why, this is Sally Wilkerson's work again, why high ozone can be a real problem for plants, particularly droughted plants. And I'm focusing on the red bars and the green bars here, and you can see that this is the effect of drought stress on stone metal conductance. The drought stress is getting worse. The stomata are closing. These are ozonated plants. They're receiving 70 parts per billion ozone. There's more ozone out there today than 70 parts per billion, I'm sure. In Northern Europe, this is a reasonable background concentration now, and it's predicted to get higher. So what ozone is doing is locking open the stomata of droughted plants. It's preventing abscisic acid closing the stomata, preventing the plants responding to these drought signals that we've just looked at. Actually, the situation's worse than that. Under some circumstances, ozone can cause ABA to open stomata. So here we are on circumstances where water is less than freely available. Plants have a means of defending themselves by reducing gas exchange using ABA signals to deliver that, and actually the signal's now working in another direction and water loss is increased. So we're suggesting that this can be a serious problem. These are stresses that occur together, and we need to try to do something about it. Well, there are chemical ways of addressing this, and there's chemical that's been used as a research tool which prevents ethylene from binding in the leaf on the membrane. It's a chemical called 1-MCP. And you can see the effect of it here in droughted plants. They're actually plants that have been treated with a low concentration of ABA. In clean air, the 1-MCP has effectively no effect on conductance. The conductance is reduced compared to well-watered plants or plants without ABA. You can see here in ozonated air, we've got this stomata are locked open. They are unable to respond to the ABA. But if you stop ethylene working, you stop ethylene binding with 1-MCP, you can restore the stomatal response to drought. Now, AgriFresh Dow and Syngenta are currently looking at formulating 1-MCP for use pre-harvest in the field. They're doing trials around the world, and they've made some of these data available to us, and they've got very interesting, invariably positive effects of using 1-MCP, which they've are now calling Vinsa, using this, the impact of that on yield on a variety of crops applied at different concentrations and different times of year. So that's, for me, is a quite an interesting proof of concept, worth going for. Some of Yanchang Yang's data, again, on partitioning, looking at the sensitivity of grain filling of wheat to the ABA-ACC ratio, you can see a nice relationship here, suggesting that higher levels of ACC have quite damaging effects on reproductive development. I'd like to just use that relationship to illustrate how I think we could think of this ratio as a target, both for management changes in crop management, which might impact positively on crop per drop, and the genetics of this situation. So here are the stresses which interest us, and I believe that high temperature will cause us to slide back down this curve, reducing grain filling because ACC has gone up. Drought somewhere in here because of a playoff between ABA and ACC. This is a well-known interaction, and Bob Sharp, I think, if he has time, will touch on this. He has some very distinguished papers in this area, and the ozone also quite significantly. We think that there will be genetic variation. Well, in fact, there is. We know already genetic variation in this relationship, and that moving further to the right, this is a phase of this curve which potentially can be of interest to us in terms of selecting genotypes which may prove to be elite in particular environments. So what we're suggesting is that we could exploit genetic variation to modify environmental sensitivity of yield or indeed resource use efficiency. And I'm not just talking about gas exchange. I'm trying to emphasize that I think we're looking at an impact across a suite of variables which underpin yield, that it is not realistic to think in terms of, oh, well, let's just look at the sensitivity of these processes to ethylene, as has often been the case in the past, because in plants that have low concentrations of ABA, it's clear ethylene is inhibitory in its own right, but that you can change the shape of that relationship if a plant is mildly droughted. So I guess this is a plea to look at a realistic suite of physiological variables across a realistic suite of climate conditions. And we're trying to do that as part of a couple of projects, the DROPS project, which is an EU-funded project, a large number of partners, companies and continents. Graham Hammer's also involved. He may talk about this. These are some of the traits we're working in here, but we're also interested in the way that some of that biology impacts on some of these other things. So that's drought-resistant plants. It's coordinated by François Tardieu in Montpellier. We're looking at the same kind of thing in relation to yield potential, and this is the Wheat Yield Consortium, which is being pushed ahead by Matt Reynolds at CIMMYT, and we hope to be involved with this as it unfolds, and have a feeling that the sort of biology that I've talked to you will underpin yield potential as well. I just want to finish with two or three slides, which focus on another way of manipulating ethylene biology, which is, I think, particularly relevant to conservation agriculture, which has been a subject of some debate around here this week. And I'm thinking here about the possibility of signaling between the rhizosphere and the plant. We know that there are bacteria, free-living bacteria, closely associated with root systems, which break down ACC, which is the immediate precursor of ethylene in the plant. And the hypothesis, which Bernie Glick and others have put forward over the years, is that the use of these beneficial bacteria might impact the ethylene balance of the plant, and that one might be able to counteract some of these negative effects of ethylene accumulation, which we've discussed as a result of some that occur as a result of some of these stresses. We're interested actually in the systemic nature of this. Is it possible to use soil bacteria to modify ethylene balance within the roots, but also the ethylene balance in the shoots? And we've done some work on that. This is a paper in collaboration with Andrei Belimov in St. Petersburg. Ian Dodd is also involved in this. You can see the effects of drought stress on peas. This is in pots, but we've repeated it now for 3 years in the field and find effectively the same results. So here's the drought stress effect, a mild stress effect. If we add the bacteria, we can recover some of that. It's quite a significant effect, about 30%. It's also a very positive effect of the bacterium on nodulation, which is another process which is known to be ethylene sensitive. There are also bacteria which produce other chemicals, cytokinins, which can be beneficial. An addition of those can also seemingly impact positively on yields in the field. My final slide, I think an urgent response is needed. This is a slide from Min Chen's paper showing how genetics, you won't be able to read it, but genetics and physiology has contributed to the yield increase that we saw. There's a lot of things that have been done by a combination of those things. I'm suggesting that we can do more, but we need to do it quickly. I think we need to reinforce key disciplines and not forget that we need physiology and soil science and one or two of the other things perhaps less fashionable. It needs to be cross-disciplinary, and I think it needs to be international. And this is the Food Security Initiative, which Jeff alluded to at the start. We're interested in trying to push forward with a consortium of people who could impact on the international stage. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you very much.